Welcome. You are listening to Assurance in Action, the podcast of your total quality assurance provider, Intertek. Our episode today is titled Improving Sourcing Standards within the UK Apparel Sector and features Intertek's Justin Betty and Catherine Beer, and very special guests David Camp from Alliance HR Limited and Alistair Knox from the Association of Suppliers to the British Clothing Industry. And without further ado, here is this special episode recorded live with the Ethical Sourcing Forum.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Intertek's Ethical Sourcing Forum podcast titled Improving Sourcing Standards Within the UK Apparel Sector. These ESF events are a feature of Intertek's Business Assurance and Supply Chain Division, with a focus on collaboratively discussing key social and sustainability subjects that impact our customers, business, and supply chain stakeholders. My name is Justin Betty, and I'm the Director of Strategic Partnerships based in our London head office, working within our Business Assurance Division. This is the first of three autumn podcasts focusing on the UK apparel sector and the labour and human rights risks that exist within it. These three podcasts will discuss and explore several different perspectives of this subject with input from expert guest speakers and stakeholder representatives. Our first podcast today in this series is called Is the UK Apparel Sector Really Broken? And we'll discuss with our panel of experts some of the drivers of worker exploitation in the UK apparel sector, as well as potential activities to improve the situation. The later podcasts we have in this series are called Is Enforcement the Panacea for Exploitation of UK Apparel Workers? And then the third one, Can a UK Sourcing Hub Be Competitive, Resilient and Put Workers Central? So more information will be available on these two podcasts very soon, so please do keep an eye out for them. So let's get started today with some other introductions. My Intertek colleague here today is Catherine Baer. So Catherine, can I ask you to introduce yourself and our distinguished speakers today, please? Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Justin, and good morning, afternoon, evening, whatever time it is with you when you're listening to this podcast. My name is Catherine Beer. As Justin said, I'm the Senior Director of Supply Chain Assurance based in our London, UK head office, working for our Business Assurance Division within Intertek. And today I'm delighted to be joined by two fantastic speakers to kick off this series. I'll give a short introduction to each, but then let me pass over to each of them to briefly tell us a little bit more about their organisation, as I'm sure they'll do a much better job than I would. Firstly, I'm going to introduce David Camp, who is the founder and chief executive of Alliance HR, which is a not-for-profit, profit-with-purpose consultancy delivering collaborative programmes to drive systemic human rights improvements in global supply chains. And they do that across the topics of modern slavery, labour standards, and responsible recruitment. And David received the 2018 Marsh Award for outstanding contribution to the fight against modern slavery. So congratulations on receiving that really impressive accolade, David. Then we're also joined by Alistair Knock, who is chairman for the organisation of ASBCI, which is a membership organisation. Alistair will tell us a bit more about that in a second. Alistair became chairman in 2013 after several years as treasurer and finance director within the group. Prior to his retirement, he was also a senior lecturer, then research fellow at Nottingham Trent University. And his teaching and research owed much to his previous industrial career of over 20 years with Courtaulds in a variety of technical and management roles. So truly living the role for 20 plus years before coming into the membership organisation to help the members. So David, let me pass over to you first to tell us a little bit about your organisation.
Thank you, Catherine, and thank you, Justin, and good morning, afternoon, good evening to everyone. And it's a great pleasure to share some thoughts and experiences today. So I've managed and led a trade association, the Association of Labour Providers, which predominantly operates in the food and agricultural sectors. And it's a trade association that promotes responsible recruitment into those sectors. From the work within that organization, we became aware of a level of hidden exploitation that was taking place. And we formed a program called Strong Together, which has grown over the years. And Strong Together is now a multi-stakeholder collaborative initiative, which supports businesses and other organizations to address modern slavery risks within their own business and their supply chains. From some work that we were doing on that, that led us into working in the UK garment sector, and we were asked to put together a programme to uncover practices that were being widely reported in the media. So we formed a programme together with a number of garment retailers called Fast Forward, and we describe that as a next generation audit and improvement program to uncover hidden exploitation and drive collaborative continuous improvement. We work with lots of garment and general merchandise brands and retailers on that program. And it's extensively used in the UK in these sectors. We do other work in globally on driving responsible recruitment practices, but I think that's enough from me at the moment. Thank you, Catherine.
Lovely. Thank you, David. And now over to Alistair. Alistair, if you can tell us a little bit more about the Association of Suppliers to the British Clothing Industry, please.
Yes, thank you, Catherine, and hello, everybody. Yes, the ASBCI is essentially a trade association for the clothing, fashion and textile sector that concentrates on spreading good practice in areas of technical and management topics in the industry. So we put on conferences and seminar type events, and in recent years that has included topics such as ethical clothing supply. Our membership involves many from the biggest names in the industry, the Next, Marks and Spencers, Burberry's, people like that, all the way through individuals, testing houses, universities, and individual members. So it's a fairly broad spectrum of membership. And we would like to think that all of our members operate to best practice and ethical standards. And obviously that's the sort of thing that we want to encourage, whether the suppliers are from what's left of the UK industry or from global suppliers. I would say that in my Courtaulds days, those were the years when we had a huge clothing manufacturing industry. It's virtually all gone. There are a few left, but I think the problems today tend to be with some of the newer, smaller companies that are in this area. So it should be a very interesting morning. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Thank you very much, Alistair and David, for that. So Justin, back over to you.
Thank you, Catherine. Yes. So back to today's podcast, and the first in this three-part series, is the UK apparel sector really broken? Purchasing practices, increasing costs, and the culture all add up to a UK apparel supply chain that struggles to meet legislation, human rights, and safety standards demanded upon it. But are these just excuses, or is the UK apparel sector really broken, and in places will continue failing to meet the most basic of requirements? There are clearly broken elements of the UK apparel sector that are impacting people, reputation, and complicity with illegal activity. Changes in business and culture and behaviour within the apparel sector is critical if improvements are to be made. How should the various stakeholders work together to take ownership, accountability, and drive the required changes? So I'd like to start off with a few questions to the panel, to David and Alistair. So first question, David, Alistair. There are ethical and good quality apparel suppliers in the UK, but as we know, also unethical ones that exploit workers and clearly break the law. How prevalent do you think this exploitation is? And maybe I'll start with you, David, on that one.
In the work that we've done in Fast Forward with a significant number of brands and retailers over the last few years, we've focused particularly on the fast fashion sector. And there are a number of ethically operating fast fashion businesses, but in the experience that we've found a number of unacceptable practices to be significantly prevalent in unethical fast fashion manufacturing. And these have ranged from practices up to and including forced labor and modern slavery, wholesale disregard for employment laws, health and safety laws. We've seen structured false directorships, phoenixing, endemic tax evasion, falsification of timesheets and payslips, collusion models that bring workers in through benefit fraud. And so we've seen this as significant and ongoing cases of this, and reported in the media and reported to government inquiries. And you use an interesting word, Justin, and you use a word broken. And I think it's important to look at what that word broken means. And I think that's in my definition, that's a supply chain where labor exploitation is egregious, where there is gross underpayment of national minimum wage, where there is an almost complete absence of employment contracts, the terms that go with that, such as holiday pay, where tax evasion, there's gross tax evasion as a norm, where there are prevalence of vulnerable workers, and a broken market where it's impossible or almost impossible to compete legally. And I would add a further condition to that definition of broken. It's where approaches such as voluntary compliance initiatives and existing enforcement mechanisms have proven unsuccessful or inadequate. So certainly within our experience, within particularly unethical fast fashion, it has been endemic over the last many years.
Right. Yeah. And David, that's quite damning of the industry. And, you know, when you say it's endemic, it alludes to this is more widespread than maybe what we think it could be. To Alistair, I mean, you represent obviously a lot of members in the apparel sector. What's your view, and maybe what's their view of the prevalence and how endemic is this exploitation? What have you heard, and what are your members saying?
Well, of course, we have several many good traditional UK brands and manufacturers, the likes of Barbara and Burberry and John Smedley and David Nieper and so on, who you know, are well above any suspicion as far as this sort of thing is concerned. There have been these allegations of unethical practices that I've been aware of for the past 30 or 40 years. It tends to be anecdotal. There have been relatively few prosecutions. Obviously, David is much more aware of nitty-gritty detail than I and my members are of this, but we've all heard these rumors, and surely there is, you know, there's no smoke without fire. What's interesting is that there have been relatively few direct complaints for those who have suffered this. It tends to be from external investigators, such as David, who are casting a light on this. So very difficult to know how prevalent it is. But there's clearly, you know, in one or two areas, it seems to be understood and well known that this goes on. How widespread it is, I don't know if anybody actually knows.
And I think you raised a good point there, and we're talking about, you know, people. These are workers, but we can't forget these are people, these human beings that are being exploited. And when you are being put in a position of exploitation, you know, it's very difficult to raise a voice and be seen. This is an issue that's heard and often not seen. But in terms of that, Catherine, I know you've got an interesting question aligned to that coming up. So over to you for that one.
Yeah, no, a really good point, I think, to make on that, because it is very hard to quantify. And maybe this one's slightly more towards yourself, David, but we're actually talking here about the apparel sector. But we know that the apparel sector is not the only sector where worker exploitation exists, certainly, you know, not only from the media conversations, but certainly with the work that you and others would do. So what do you see as the common denominators that make workers more vulnerable to exploitation? And what can be done to support, I guess, and empower them so that they can protect themselves? And putting it towards yourself, David, because I guess your work has brought you more in touch with some of those real realities and actually maybe even hearing from some of the workers yourselves.
Yes, absolutely. And there are particular vulnerabilities which make individuals more susceptible to finding themselves in this situation. I can talk pretty extensively on this, essentially it's an abuse of vulnerability by those in a more powerful position. Now, vulnerability may be caused through a number of factors, a lack of life choices, a lack of work availability, a life situation where it's necessary to accept any work that's available just to eat and survive. In any country, lack of the native language puts someone in a more vulnerable position. So where those who don't have English language skills are put in a more difficult position. Those without the correct immigration status to work legally in the UK also puts them at heightened risks. And there is also sort of cultural pressures which come from working in a very tight community, whereby it would be unheard of to speak out against those who you live close to and within the community with which you conduct your life. The other vulnerability which has been uncovered and reported on numerous times is the collusion model, where workers are required to work many hours per week, 50, 60 hours a week, at a rate significantly below the minimum wage, £3.75, £3.50 to £4 regularly reported. Yet the workers are given pay slips which report 15 to 20 hours worked at minimum wage, which enables them to receive the maximum level of state benefit. So the workers are made collusive in benefit fraud, which also puts them in a situation where they do not feel comfortable being able to report to the authorities. And in fact, to address any issue through the authorities, through the systems that exist, such as Citizens Advice Bureau, such as ACAS, such as the tribunal system, is just not something that is done. And those individuals who engage workers under these terms are aware of this and understand that that these workers are unlikely to come forward. What can be done? There are a number of issues which need to be addressed. Firstly, there needs to be enforcement against the businesses that are conducting these practices. Secondly, workers need to feel that they can come forward and that they are safe in coming forward. There is a whole process that needs to go through with regard to community engagement, mm-hmm. with regard to community communication with these individuals, that they have roots, that they understand, that they have people that they trust that they can go to, and so on. And I appreciate where we have limited time. I could talk for another 10, 15 minutes on this, but I hope I've covered the key points in that, and happy if you want to follow up on any of those.
No, that's fantastic, David. I think what you highlighted there was quite key in terms of, you know, contextualizing for everybody. Okay, it won't always be these types of workers, but majority of the time what we're finding is that is the circumstances that these people are in. And I think language, culture, where they come from are some really important key points you touched upon, because that obviously does impact how you can then help them be empowered to do something. You have to think about what that local cultural support network would be to let them know you are not alone and there is a safe network in which you can reach out and be supported. And we're certainly seeing a lot of activities, you know, both from government downwards to local level that is trying to do that. But obviously, you know, we will continue to need more routes through that. And as you say, this is something that we could spend an entire day debating and talking on.
Yeah, absolutely, Catherine. I'd just like to just kind of please come back on two points, which when you reflect, you realise that it's key vulnerability, migrant workers. I didn't particularly specify that, but there is always a risk around migrant workers who are in a country and culture that they are less familiar with, working in a language that they are less familiar with. And in terms of support out of this, of course, there is also the key role that trade unions have to play in engaging with these sectors and these communities and these vulnerable workers, which tend to be sort of underrepresentative in the trade union movement. So I think there's good piece of work to be addressed there as well.
Yeah, no, good ad. I mean, maybe let's just stick with you for a second, David. And I mean, Justin, maybe if we pick up some of the licensing points with David, that would be a good idea.
Yeah, so good conversation there. I think, you know, we have to speak about, you know, those people that are underrepresented, that for whatever their situation, as we just discussed, don't feel empowered to raise concerns and the exploitation that they're under. So why not, you know, do we take control of the situation and maybe license the apparel production, which, you know, David, as you know, this is something that's being proposed. And I mean, from your views, David, if we license the apparel sector in the UK, would that possibly be a stronger, quicker solution here? Would it have the teeth to try to in protecting workers and bring to account those suppliers that are not behaving ethically? So what do you think about licensing? Do you think it could be a good way forward?
Yeah, thanks, Justin. So yeah, I have a lot of experience in this because I have worked within the food and agricultural sector, and I run a trade association for labour providers that are licensed. They're licensed by the Gangmasters and Labour Abuse Authority that came into force back in 2006, following the drownings of Chinese cockle pickers in Morecambe Bay. And I've seen the positive effect that licensing has had on that sector and how it has enabled the industry to professionalise, how it's enabled labour providers to compete more fairly. Licensing is something that should be used should not be sort of widely used throughout industry, but it should be used where indeed those factors that I identified early on that says this is a broken supply chain and it's almost impossible to compete legally and fairly. So I think there is a role for licensing of apparel manufacturing. There are many others who support that view as well, particularly being led by the British Retail Consortium, who have written to the Home Secretary arguing that case. And the British Retail Consortium are supported in that approach by a wide group of MPs, a wide group of retailers, a wide group of investors, a wide group of NGOs. So there is almost, there is a very wide multi-stakeholder support for that. Now, licensing can, what sort of licensing is appropriate? Well, we haven't got time to go into the detail of that. I don't think it needs to be hugely complex. I think, as BRC have described it, it needs to be a fit to trade. It needs to look at the history of the business. It needs to look at the history of the directors it needs to look at history of tax payments and minimum wage payments and a couple of other areas. It does not need to be vastly bureaucratic. We have the mechanisms through the Gangmasters and Labour Abuse Authority set up to manage this. And I think at this time, I feel it is the fastest and most effective way to create a significant change within particularly fast fashion in the UK.
So, great. And I was just thinking as you were speaking to David, Alistair, for you, you're representing a membership organisation. I mean, for licensing, I assume that you know that will then make more of an even playing field for your members as well. Have you got any quick comment on that one?
Well, I'm not sure that more law and more red tape is the answer when the problem is clearly there seems to be some already illegal activity. And if the problem is the balance between, you know, exploited workers accepting £3 or £4 an hour or being deported, it's a different sort of problem. That doesn't need more law and more licensing and more regulation. You've got a situation where there is law already, and action can be taken.
I mean, I just on that, I completely agree with Alistair. We don't need more law. The laws all exist there, but the laws are not enforced, and the licensing doesn't add any new laws. It's just a sort of a pre-qualification, a pre-assessment that businesses are complying with these laws, and it provides an effective means to do that. And so I agree. Don't need any new laws. We just need a mechanism, the easiest mechanism to ensure adherence to existing laws.
Yeah. Now let's see whether that's going to be via enforcement or licensing. You know, let's see. You know what the coming months will bring, because I know that's those two subjects are up for discussion. Changing direction a little bit, Catherine. I know you've got a question around sort of sourcing. So just change direction.
And I think this one will be quite interesting, David. Alistair, I'm going to start with you in this one. Obviously, you know, as you say, it's been a very interesting time over the last few years in terms of the way the sourcing cycles have changed and the way they're re-changing again now, post-COVID new world. So has the sourcing cycle become so short that it's inevitable that someone could get exploited? And I guess where I'm coming from with this is, how do brands, suppliers and other stakeholders build an open and transparent and honest relationship with each other? So if we really want to see, you know, manufacturing in the UK with these short cycles, etc., how do we do that?
That's a good question. And actually, this shortening of cycles has been going on for 20, 30 years. And of course, that's one of the benefits of a UK manufacturing base, is that you save the shipping time from, say, the Far East or South Asia. So there is this balance between speed and cost. And there's some very good, if you look globally, some very good exemplars like Inditex, the Zara owner in Spain, who have some factories, you know, right on site in Spain, even though they may get the bulk made overseas as well, but they have developed that fast fashion relationship with their own factories. Bit more difficult here, but yes, the ideal situation is when you do get a partnership, more open information flow between manufacturer and supplier, and where the brand, the buyer, does accept that if it's made locally, yes, you may get it faster, but you might have to pay a little bit more for it if it's going to be made in appropriate ethical standards way.
I agree.
Does that
Thank
answer
you.
Your question, Catherine?
It does indeed. No, it's just making me reflect again, you know, on some of the customer conversations I've actually had and some really good points there that will be interesting to have with them. I mean, David, anything you want to add to that question?
I would just add that I don't think that we can accept that that it's inevitable that people are exploited. And I do believe that open, transparent and honest relationships are absolutely key. So what we have seen is an increasing number of brands and retailers who are publishing their suppliers. What we are seeing is programs such as Fast Forward, which do drive collaborative relationships between suppliers and manufacturers and their clients. Mm-hmm. And speaking about the UK, at the end of 2018, the Apparel and General Merchandise Public-Private Protocol, not the catchiest name, AGMPPP for short, drove a collaboration between brands and retailers and the public sector, a number of the enforcement bodies. And we have a meeting this week, and we are the group is re-examining itself, which is how can it truly become a multi-stakeholder group to work together to improve these social standards in apparel and general merchandise manufacturers. So we are seeing positive signs of relationships developing in this area.
Okay, interesting. Justin, maybe let's just stick on onshoring for a second. I think you had a question around that.
Carrying on with that theme, I mean, we've all travelled around the world. We've been to extremely modern, computerised apparel factories in countries outside of the UK. And I know from my experience, some of the manufacturing in the UK is very old. Machinery is very old. The skills are being lost, and it's not a sector that young people are being attracted to. So, but Alistair, you know, to build on that, what, you know, do you think it's, you know, the business case exists for the apparel sector to have investment and to be a hub? I mean, can we see investment by your members maybe in new factories, new warehousing to supply the UK market? Do you think that could be a reality?
In some respects, there are possibilities, but if I can just say that one of my last jobs with Courtauld, and I'm talking back in the 1990s, was to help set up world-class factories overseas where we could use the cheap labour and world-class factories. We had, you know, one of the most advanced clothing industries in the world here in the UK at that time. So bringing it back, it's a question of balance, and really there is an argument for having a proportion of your supply base locally and not having it 100% overseas for the big brands and the big retailers. Mm. It's really a question of if you're talking about encouraging investment and modern machinery, etc., you'll only invest if you can see a long-term payback. And one of the problems with particularly short cycle, fast fashion sourcing is that, you know, a long-term strategy is from here to next month, not from here to 5 years hence. And there are very few buyers who are prepared to commit to paying more than they would in Vietnam, Bangladesh, wherever, for the next 5 years to a UK factory. But that's what you need. You need that sort of decision by the brand, by the retailer, to say, okay, we will be taking, you know, 5%, 10%, whatever of our manufacturing will be done locally. There's an excellent example earlier on this year. You probably all remember the hoo-ha about the supply of PPE, personal protective equipment, for the health service and others. And I was contacted, along with many others, by the Cabinet Office who wanted, you know, instant. We want volume and we want pace. Well, you can't magic a factory out of nothing with advanced materials and specialist equipment instantly. It has to be a long-term commitment. And what I recommended to them was that, you know, in future and be prepared for the next pandemic, by all means get low-cost bulk from abroad, but make sure that you have a facility, 10-20% of your essential equipment made in the UK. If it was that vital for the country, you know, if it was the armed services and you're talking about guns and bullets, you wouldn't have all of those made in China.
Yeah. No, it's an interesting take as well, I guess, when we find ourselves, you know, in a position where, unemployment is beginning to soar, and what does the future look like in terms of supporting not only that point right now, but thinking about what's important for the UK apparel industry as a whole going forward. So I think that's interesting. Taking the PPE example and sort of then redeploying it back to apparel in general, what should be the thoughts of the industry as a whole? But as you said, that needs to start with those conversations with the brands and understanding what their needs are too.
And I'm conscious of time. I was just going to say many of them are well aware of this sort of conundrum, and some of it boils down to the way you do your costing and what else you put into the figures. How do you balance speed and stock availability against just a simple costing for the factory gate cost? So there are many factors at work here, and I know that several of our members are seriously looking at how do they get the right balance and persuade the rest of the business strategically that yes, we need to source a proportion in the UK, and obviously do it ethically and sustainably.
I completely agree with Alistair there is a relook at purchasing practices taking place, and I think there is an ability, a will, and I think the time is right for us to look at how we can rebuild our fashion and textile manufacturing industries so that we have an innovative sector and an export-led sector that is able to invest and look to the future, delivering good skilled jobs. And Alistair made the point, those businesses need to have commitment to make those investments. But I think that through collaboration I think by ensuring that those manufacturing businesses are operating fairly ethically, legally, that we can build those relationships from which to regrow this industry ready for the decades ahead.
Yeah, thank you. So we're very conscious of time, gentlemen, but I'd really like to just have one last reflection from you both. So maybe you can give me your last 1 minute thoughts on. We've obviously seen, just tying it back together again and where we started at the beginning, we've seen, you know, a number of different statements or practice changes or commitments from various companies over the last number of months in response to the media articles that we saw in the summer over worker exploitation in the apparel sector. I guess maybe I'll start with you, David, and then move on to Alistair. But one last 1 minute thought from you on what more needs to be done in your view.
Okay, I'm very cautiously optimistic, but we've seen we've seen increased involvement from investor organisations, and I think that will continue. We've seen increased activity and awareness from enforcement bodies. We've seen different retailers take different commercial decisions, and I would particularly focus on ASOS and their transparency pledge with their online third-party brands. I've seen different NGOs and come together to form a common view, and I've seen different stakeholders coming together. The answers are far from perfectly developed, but I have seen significant progress this summer. It is always disappointing that it takes that it seems to take a tragedy or significant media expose to drive this action, but that appears to be the reality of the situation.
No, and I think that is the sad reality, unfortunately. Alistair, final thoughts from you on this topic?
Yes, I agree with David. It's good to see that companies like ASOS and Next, who took the action, when there was a question about Boohoo sourcing, to drop them, because nobody wants to be associated with this sort of thing. But even Boohoo themselves, they recognise that this is a problem, and they appear to be wanting to take action to fix it. It's not an easy thing to fix when you've got perhaps things like subcontracting. So you might give a contract to one good supplier, and if there's pressure on time and cost, things might get subcontracted to others who are not in the same inspection regime. So it is difficult, but it is good to see proper companies taking proper action, and hopefully this sort of thing can be eliminated.
Great. I think we're practically out of time, which is a real shame. I think we're just starting to get into some meaty subjects, particularly on root cause and sourcing there. But that does leave us nicely positioned for the next podcast in this series called Is Enforcement the Panacea for Exploitation of UK Apparel Workers? Again, we really have some great special guest speakers for that one. And so, look, once again, thank you both, David and Alistair, so much for your time and sharing your thoughts with everyone listening to this podcast. And I know that this podcast, will send some links out relating to the ALP, Fast Forward and Stronger Together, as well as for the Association of Suppliers to the British Clothing Industry. So look, thank you again, everyone. Thank you all of you out there for listening. And we'll join you on the next podcast in the series. So thank you and have a great day, everyone.